Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
New Earth Relic. TJ Denzer.
Whoa, Mackie.
What?
You're early.
Yeah.
Can you disconnect and call in a minute when you'd be late? No, I'm kidding. It's great. Thank you.
Okay.
She actually did it.
Yep.
Good job, Dan. You walked into that one.
That was perfect.
Hello, and welcome to episode 285. I am TJ Denzer, here with Dan Q.
The heat is on.
Makalua.
I'm still very confused right now.
Mad Jin.
Dan took too much effort to be able to get himself to say something clearly so he could work it into post-edit.
And New Earth Relic.
This week I am apparently putting the fill in filthy casual.
Unique ability, all roads lead to Rome, which their cities start with a trading post. They automatically build roads to new cities within trade range of their capital. That's an important distinction. You can't build something on the far side of Pangaea and expect it to automatically get connected. And it also increases their gold income from trade routes going through their cities. Yeah. So, did you want to do trading with Rome? Because you're probably going to end up doing trading with Rome.
Rome, just that little bonus, even just for movement, it's just really, really nice early game bonus.
Yeah, because you're not slogging through a bunch of hills or forests or stuff. It's like, need to reinforce that city?
Yep.
You're there.
Yeah, because sure, I mean, you can establish, otherwise it's Rome, trade routes between your cities, and internal trade routes can definitely be beneficial, and not just for the road, but it's not instant poof either.
But also, most importantly, since it's a trade post that's dropped along with the road, not only are your cities road connected, but your trade post connected, which means your trade routes from Rome can reach much, much further. Because they have automatic trading posts already, so they extend your range.
Yeah, so you could get a road to that city on the other side of Pangaea, but you're going to have to basically outpost your way there.
Well, I mean, if you drop a city in between yourself and, say, a potential trading partner, everybody else would have to put a road out to that new city that you just dropped first to get the trading post there, and so that'll take a long time. And then you can send the trade route out to the other civ. Or use two and split it. And this way, you don't even have to bother with that.
And then, of course, now that you've got these instant road between your cities, and then your trade routes get that plus one gold for passing through trading posts in your own cities, of which you already have a trading post to begin with. Nice.
Yeah, I guess early on, no one's close enough. You can just do your internal trade routes and grow your cities faster.
Yeah, you have to.
It happens.
Obviously, city placement is super important for everyone, but Rome has an extra sort of responsibility in trying to build cities where everyone will have to go to get to other cities.
Yeah, you'd hope, but there's no, hey, look, this is the best trade city, and everybody wants to send their trade routes to that city because that's where all the good stuff is. Like, there's no Venice in-game. There's no, like, I've got all the trade connections to the Ottomans, and anybody who wants anything through the Ottomans has to send the trade route to me because the Ottomans won't let you send it directly. There's none of that.
I don't think you can talk about instant poofing with Rome without talking about the unique ability of their leader at the same time.
Yeah, tracing his free monuments. Well, there's one free building.
Yep.
Doesn't necessarily have to be the monument, or just auto-pick the monument?
It's automatically the cheapest building, and the monument just happens to be the cheapest building.
Cheapest building.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, why don't they just say free monument?
Because they future-proofed it and modder-proofed it. So if a modder comes out and goes, hey, I'm going to put in this new building, it's going to be super cheap and easy for everybody to build, and it's going to give something, then Rome will get all of that instead.
Okay.
Also, I think in advanced starts, you get free buildings.
Yeah. There's just one last thing to think about. Okay, so when am I going to get my monument up and running? Oh, wait, it already is.
When am I going to get into political philosophy? Oh, wait, I already am.
Yay! I'll just drop more cities and research it faster.
Yep.
Well, and instantly get them hooked up.
Civic it faster.
Mass culture.
8-turn building and no turns is still an 8-turn building and no turns.
Yep. And that's 8 more turns worth of culture.
Yeah, that's right.
which means using policies right away.
It works in terms of building other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, get yourself to political philosophy first. Start writing some great person points, like, oh, I'm already on track to a great scientist. Nanner, nanner.
Yeah, then he also has a really fun agenda where he Optimus Principle.
Transformers agenda.
Tries to include as much territory as possible to his empire and does not like civilizations which control little territory. Oh, really?
It's also called the OP leader agenda.
That's true. Yeah, I love meeting Rome on turn 10 and they're bitching me for, why do you control so little territory? Because it's turn 10. I've already got three cities.
Yeah.
You're a cheaty AI. Of course you have three cities.
I'm trying to remember if that counts as actual hexes covered by culture borders or if that's based on number of cities. Because number of cities would be kind of crappy. If it was actually based on culture borders, then that would be probably a little nicer. It would also make sure that Rome instantly liked Russia. But.
Yeah, I thought it was based on territory, because if you go into the world ranking screen and you're looking at the score, when it gives you your territorial score, it's not just the cities you have.
Yeah, but the leader agendas aren't always exactly what they say they are.
Well, no, that's definitely true. Although, quite frankly, if Rome is one of my opponents and they tell me, hey, you control very little territory, I can say, so you control a lot. And what's that? All of your cities are connected by roads, so I can go and smash your first city and then just we hop along Cassidy onto your next city? Okay. Then I'll control lots of territory. You'll like me then, right? Right? Now, speaking of conquering, I guess Rome would like to do some of that as well.
Legions. A little bit more expensive than a normal swordsman. Doesn't require iron. Which was really confusing the first time I had played them in Civ 6, because I was used to legions having to have iron. And I was like, wait, what? And they can build forts early on, which they only have one build charge. They have a Roman fort, slightly different from the normal fort. They can build that early. They have that one charge. And musketmen. You keep upgrading them. You can't upgrade them to musketmen and still run around and be able to build a fort.
The Roman fort's pretty nice. You get automatic two turns worth of fortification, which gives you your +6 defense. But it also means you can shoot and automatically fortify on the same turn if you move an archer into that fort.
Ooh.
It's really, really useful.
Does that still work if you're playing with siege units, you know, like catapults, trebuchets?
Yes, I'm pretty sure. I mean, as for the legion itself, yeah, it has slightly greater strength than your swordsman. What is it? It's like 40 as compared to 36.
Yeah.
But it also costs a little more. 110 production instead of 90.
Yeah, but you also get more combat strength, so.
And a free fort.
Yeah.
What you're building is a fort-building pack for them to take along with them.
As if Rome needed any more nice things. Speaking of things on the map that they can build.
Oh, yeah, baths. Placement for the aqueduct. I think a bit more housing and then also an amenity.
Yeah, yeah. Top of the what the aqueduct can give you, you're going to get +2 housing and then +1 amenity from entertainment.
Plus, it also doesn't take up a district slot, so you can build that and then keep building more districts.
Yep. The bath is kind of the, oops, we broke some mechanics.
Whoopsies.
Yeah. It's everything that you want out of a district that you're going to put on every city ever.
Yep. Of course, you need access to water.
Yeah. Either a lake or a mountain or a river.
When we're talking about, well, Civilization VI or any Civ, there are always people that want to say, like, so, give me the Cliffs Notes. Is it upper tier, middle tier, or lower tier?
Lower tier.
Absolutely, 100%.
Completely.
I don't go out of my way to play Rome. I don't typically say, okay, I want to play as Rome, so I select that in a new game. But if I roll Rome, I'm never unhappy. Upper tier.
Yeah,
it's pretty strunk out of the gate.
And it's on that list of Civs that you're kind of, they're not like the first tier of threat that you're not happy to see, but they're definitely up there. You're like, ah, crap, it's Rome. You know, this is going to be a pain in my ass at some point.
Although if you're playing single player, as long as you expand yourself a little bit, Rome will end up picking on somebody else instead. Because they do like expanding, especially with legions.
They'll be, okay, you're big enough, I won't pick on you. You over there, though.
Well, I won't pick on you yet.
Yeah.
Yes. At that point where I become bigger than you, then I'll start picking on you. But until then, you're safe.
Which, of course, if they go and take over someone else first, then they probably are bigger than you, and now they don't like you.
Yeah.
If you're playing against Rome, they don't necessarily have to be your first target. Like, they have to get off the map. But I do want this policy of containment.
Yep. Easiest way to trim down Rome, knock them out before they get to legions.
Yeah, I think that's easier said than done, though.
Well, if you take out their first couple cities, then they'll have a city. Maybe. And then you can just sit there and leave them. Like, maha, tiny room.
if you're on a really large continent and they're on another continent in another part of the world and you let them grow, then why is your luck skill so bad? Why weren't you near Rome to get rid of them?
Totally true. Unlike, say, anybody with really, really early game stuff, they have the right timing early game stuff.
And timing is everything.
Yep.
We got Russia.
Mother Russia is back. Gain lots and lots of territory when you found a city. Woo! Cover the map with all your stuff. Extra faith and production from tundra tiles, which sort of makes them worth using. And we got Petra, Peter, as a leader. His grand embassy receives science and culture, or culture, from trade routes to more advanced civs. Completely and utterly stupid. Horribly useless unless you suck at playing the game. The design of this is like, oh, well, let's use a catch-up mechanic as a primary bonus for a leader. Yeah! It sucks. You have to be playing really bad for this to be good. So, don't. On top of all that space that you have, and the extra production and faith from Tundra Tiles, you get your Lavra, which is your improved version of the Holy Site. So you get twice the great prophets, writers, artists, and musicians, which is all wonderful and stuff, although I'm not really sure how Russia should have prophets, but whatever. So you're pretty much guaranteed to get a great prophet, because Lavras are cheap, they're easy to make, but since you're also spamming these, great writers, great artists, and great musicians are starting as quickly as possible without even having a theater district, and getting one of each is about the same as dropping a theater district and buildings. So as you start doing that, you will get all the good stuff. And of course, if you happen to have a Lavra in your city, you get an extra tile for using a great person in that city. So, whatever. So the big bonus for Russia is the fact that you have all that space. So when it comes to dropping districts, you don't have to worry about waiting for culture to get to the hex or spending a bunch of money to get to the hex. You just go, where's my best adjacency for this? Okay, I'm just going to drop that right there because you'll probably already have it inside your city borders.
I mean, sure, you might be moaning the fact that a lot of your territory is otherwise Spartan, as it were.
No, it depends. Not all maps are crappy.
It's just that you're biased of where you're going to start.
Well, I mean, you're going to start near a tundra. You don't actually want to start in the tundra. Well, preferably you don't want to start in the tundra. You want to start beside the tundra. That way your city can pick up some tundra tiles, but then the other side of the city will have not tundra tiles so that you can use them.
Grow.
Yeah, that too. Very much necessary for growing. They also happen to have a Cossack. Pops up military science, all the usual stuff, so it's direct replacement for the Cav. It's a unique light Cav. A little bit more production cost by a tiny bit, but you also get more combat strength, so that's okay. And then you get 5 more combat strength when you're fighting in or next to your territory, which is good. You just have a bunch of super speedy infantry, effectively.
Yeah, patrol units.
Yep, running around, smashing anybody who thinks that they're going to step into your territory.
And if you have movement points after you attack, you can use those points to move.
Yep. Just go in, smack somebody around, and back off and wander away. It's good stuff. Also good stuff because if you conquer somebody's city, then all of a sudden your Cossacks are moving even further with that new city now being in your territory. Build a bunch of horses right before you get to Cossacks and then just mass upgrade spam. Because by that point, horsemen should be super cheap to build.
In a related thread to this conversation on CFC from Denkt, quote, is Russia the strongest pick for both religious and culture victory? Question mark. Strongest, like, as an absolute. It's stronger.
Sure.
Certainly. I don't know about strongest. It depends on their start and who else is on the map and what you're doing or not doing, but it's definitely stronger.
Well, I mean, you're pretty much guaranteed to get way too many writers, a bunch of artists, and probably one musician before you even have the ability to use it. Almost guaranteed that if you spam Lavras, you will get a musician without being able to actually use it. Possibly an artist before that as well.
Well, yeah, you're going to be able to start churning out those great writer, artist, musician points before anybody else is able to blink and say, wait a minute, I want to enter the pool of being able to get these points. And you're like, no, I've already started.
All your culture belongs to us.
Well, because you got to think about that. You get the very first one only costs 30 or 40.
30.
Yeah, so 30 turns into the game, you can have a great work writing, and you just keep stealing stuff. In theory, pantheon-wise, yeah, you can go Dance of the Aurora. If you do have a ton of tundra, Dance of the Aurora and just slap your Lavra right in the middle of the tundra. It'll be great.
Yep, Holy Site District is going to get plus one faith from adjacent tundra tiles, of which you're already getting additional faith from adjacent tundra tiles. So, stacking for the win.
Woo! And then you bump that up with your scriptures, and you're good. You can run a faith economy. You don't need no stupid production or gold. Just have faith.
Of the heart.
I knew you were just going to say that.
The stabby kind. No, because you can get the stabby kind of faith where you slip into a theocracy and just faith. Crush everything under your faith.
So Russia does have the potential to be one of the more higher tier faith populations, but it really does depend on the luck of the draw when it comes to the spawn.
Well, kind of, yeah, you need the tundra. And it does help to get Dance of the Aurora for that. The extra faith and extra production from tundra trials is great. It's not just flat tundra, wooded tundra, stuff like that will also give you your faith and production. I mean, late game, yes, if you don't have any forests on your tundra, you can just run around spamming forests. That'll start making those tiles a little better. But yeah, it can be worth it to just run it.
Peter's agenda.
To westernize. So as an AI, he's friendly to those civs that are ahead of him in science and culture. Just likes the backwards ones. So yeah, the agenda is tied to the leader bonus. Basically, if the AI is doing crap, he likes you. If the AI is doing good, he won't like you because he can't use you.
How practical.
Very practical.
And I could certainly very well see myself with Rush as an opponent, maybe not being ahead of him in culture, but in science. So is it that it has to be that you have to be ahead of him in science and culture in order to get that, or could it just be one or the other? I've never paid close enough attention.
I think it's a bit of both.
A bit of both? Okay, so
I think it's average the two, basically.
Oh, okay.
Basically, if you want Peter to be nice to you, just take all his cities and
Well, then certainly, yes, you should be ahead of him then. Science and culture at that point, yes.
And also land space.
But yes, if Peter is your AI neighbor, best thing to do is leave him alive, smack him around, take his good placed cities, stay at war with him. Let them just continue placing new cities. If they're nicely placed, keep it. If they're not nicely placed, burn it. Let them try again.
And seeing as how the AI in war is like, I know what I'm going to do in war. I'm going to build a settler. You are well positioned already for him to be able to do that.
Yep.
The real question is, do you take his settler from him before or after it sells a city?
Well, after because of the extra territory that he gets.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
It would be disappointing if you think I could take the settler because I think you're going to settle it in a crappy place because then you're just going to be like, well, I don't want it. I'm just going to go ahead and raise the city. But in Peter's, and so of course by extension, Rush's case specifically, no, I'm going to roll the die and let you go ahead and found that city.
Spain's special ability is a treasure fleet. They get fleets and armadas earlier than usual, which is pretty good, except for the fact that for some reason, every map that I've played has been like two giant land masses, so your naval combat bonuses aren't terribly relevant.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, and if you get them, great. Just most of the time what I've seen is that everyone doesn't build cities on the coast, so you're just like, hey, I have this nice fleet. And they're looking longingly at that city that's one hex away off the coast.
Well, I mean, if you got a frigate, you can still bombard it.
Yep.
That's true.
You'd have to hide really far, and then you wouldn't be able to put a harbor down.
In that case, if you're Spain and the city that you're trying to take is one hex off the coast, then you bombard it with your frigate, and you have the frigate protect a melee unit that you're going to have land when there's next to no city defense left, then you take it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that part is pretty nice, at least.
Fleets and armadas generally, though, suck, because they don't give you as much of a bonus as they probably should.
Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, so instead of having two frigates, I'm going to have one unit on the map.
And it's only going to have a slightly more higher combat strength.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think I'd just rather have two on the map and, oh no, there's a little bit more maintenance. Yeah, but you still got considerably more firepower.
Yep.
I'm not saying that, okay, you take two frigates and smush them together and now they should have double strength. No. But it's so edge case right now that...
Should probably have more health.
Yeah.
Because two ships are healthier than one ship, and they do have more guns.
I mean, and this just is in Spain specifically. You could make this general mistake of creating fleets and armadas more quickly.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Otherwise, from the treasure fleet.
Yeah. Now, here comes the actual useful part of it. Trade routes, you get bonuses. The math is, I guess, 3 bonus gold to civs on other continents, Or for internal trade routes, you get plus one food, plus one production to internal trade routes. Both of which are real good because Civ 6 is Trade Route Simulator, the game. Yeah, Dan isn't saying anything to contradict that because I know for a fact that every single of his districts is commercial hub, builds a new city, so.
Well, you know, when there's nothing to disagree with, then I'm just going to let you keep rolling with it.
Yep. Their unique unit is the Conquistador, which is a more powerful musket man when you have a religious unit there. They can also convert people to Spain's religion.
Yep.
This is going to be a recurring theme with Spain, which is get yourself a religion and then build yourself some units and then use your religion and those units to crush people.
Yep.
You'll have a religion whether you like it or not.
Yep.
You can basically smash your opponents into a religious victory.
Yep. The Conquistador is actually pretty strong because of the plus 10 strength.
And if it's Spain, you've got a religion of your own, and you've adopted the Defender of the Faith, so now your units get another plus 10 combat strength, and your friendly cities that follow this religion after you've just converted the city to your religion and taken it for yourself, yes, please, try to take the city back.
Yeah, get yourself some nice, delicious plus 75 strength Conquistadors. Seems fine.
It's all good.
Isn't that the same threshold as, like, infantry?
And as compared to a standard musket man, it actually costs a little less.
Yeah. All the good bonuses on that Conquistador.
Don't forget his little extra plus 4 bonus against other people's religions.
Oh, yeah. So we're almost at 80 right there. That's actually really strong. Speaking of strong, we have the mission, which is actually kind of strong, except for the fact that it feels like it comes out really late. The mission is a tile improvement. It's a base plus 2 faith on it. If it's on a different continent than your capital, it's another 2 faith on top of it. It was next to a campus, 1 science, and when you finally get cultural heritage at the end of the game, you get 2 science, which is hilariously late.
That's just more a matter of pacing.
Yeah, congratulations, here's an atomic era tech. You get a science bonus now. Yeah! Although at that point, you should have either already won or be in the process of finishing up a win, so.
If you kind of bring all those things together, it's like, so, what am I going to win first, domination or a religious victory?
Well, I mean, if it was plus 2 culture or plus 2 tourism, actually plus 2 tourism would be better.
Plus 2 tourism would be way better.
Yeah, plus 2 tourism at that point, then even if you're not going for a tourist victory, it's a defense against that.
Yeah.
And it would make a lot more sense that cultural heritage would give you a tourism-based bonus, not a science-based bonus.
Yeah. The mission ends up being, in my mind, just pretty good. You get all the faith, but you get to start building it pretty late in the game, in which case
it shouldn't be that much of a factor.
Yeah. Like, I want my faith really early just so I can go and get all of the good faith stuff. And when it comes out at exploration, midway through the game.
Well, your faith you're accumulating isn't for and founding a religion. It's
for
the counter-reformer.
And by that you mean great people, right?
Yep. Talk about the great people later.
Yeah, it is.
Inquisitors also have that extra remove heresy.
Yeah, that's a leader bonus for Philip II.
Yep.
He gets that combat bonus, and Inquisitors get one more remove heresy charge.
If you didn't happen to use a Conquistador to take a city, you can still wander around with Inquisitors, purging the heretics, and then hand all the cities back.
Yep.
There you go. Now you're my religion.
Yep. That's Philip's big agenda. He likes people who are the same religion, and he hates people who are trying to spread their religion to his empire. So you're his
just
religion.
Just like every player.
Well, to be fair, yeah.
Spain is just bad as a civ.
Not really. It's not that bad. It's not Norway.
Yeah, they're definitely pretty bad just because I feel like all their bonuses just come way too late.
Well, it depends on way too late. Most of their bonuses come right at the beginning of the Renaissance, which is plenty of time.
Force combat with the AI in Civ 6. They don't really use it that much as far as like fighters and bombers. A lot of people have seen this as sort of a problem when it comes to the AI.
Yeah, I mean, the AI is not atrocious at constructing an aerodrome, but actually putting units in there, other than biplanes, using them at all for absolutely any kind of purpose whatsoever. That's where the fail is for me. There's so many of those empty airfields sitting there, and then they never maximize its usage.
There is no such thing as an Air Force AI. We all know this. The game just does not handle it whatsoever.
Yeah, you might see a fighter or bomber at most, but usually there's a biplane in there, and it sits there, and it sits there, and it sits there. They never upgrade, even after they're going through the tech. They never use it offensively or defensively. It is frustrating. Considering what you can do as a player with an Air Force, it's like, oh, there's this city deep within the continent. There's no way I'm going to be able to bombard it with a battleship. I could move in some field cannons. Oh, wait, no, those are getting squished pretty early. And the artillery's getting squished, plus they got to set up before they can attack. I know, I'll just use bombers. And, wow, look at that city defense go down to nothing just ever so quickly. And we've talked about that before on this show. But if you thought the AI failed on the water, which it generally does, it feels like nothing compared to the use of the Air Force, which, yes, okay, unless you're an advanced start person to a sufficient point, it's going to come up later in the game. But it's almost kind of like, thank you for constructing the airfield, so when I take your city,
I can rebase automatically.
If need be, yeah, exactly. And I don't think that's really what the airfield should be for when they're from the AI. Use them to defend yourself, or better yet, go on the offensive. But no.
No, no, no. The first few times when I was in a single-player game that happened, I was like, oh, crap, they are going to have an Air Force. And then they just sit there, la, 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 la. I'm like, okay.
In the thread on CFC, in response to it, which was the thread itself was started by R. Domico, Calix is like, I think part of the problem might be that an Air Force requires an enormous investment. You need to build an expensive district and fairly expensive units. There's a lot of investment near the end of the game when your production is likely better focused on actually winning. No, 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 you see, Calix, this is focusing on actually winning. If it's an expensive district and expensive units, part of me is thinking about how's your production base. You know, do you have industrial zone there? But actually, quite frankly, other than constructing the district itself, once I have the district, I'm finding myself, I'm buying those bombers. And as an aside, isn't it great that in the technology tree, you can research jet bombers without having to first have bombers? That's,
yeah.
That's pardon? It's like, why would you go for that? Because it's, oh yes, you could tech and get bombers first. That's true. Except that the path to go get bombers is not then a direct line to then go from bombers to jet bombers. The combat strength is a little better, but the thing that I like about a jet bomber as compared to a standard bomber is the range. So, you know, you like your counting tiles, buh, 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 buh. And yes, sometimes, you know, you're going to place an airfield, perhaps not on a tile that you would like. I always try to put my airfield kind of at the outer range of my city, so then that way I know it's got those few extra hexes to be able to get there. But it's just kind of one of those things where I don't necessarily construct an aerodrome in all of my cities, and sometimes not at all, particularly if, well, I've already got these naval units, I might as well use the bombard from the battleship. That's fine. When you're fighting a land war, and it's going to be this huge slog where you have absolutely no units on the map, but your city defenses mean that you can sit here and repel me pretty well forever in a day, then, yeah, I'm going to use them. And the fact that the AI doesn't use them at all, as I said before, they construct the district, and then they do nothing with it. It's so frustrating. It's even more frustrating when their settler just sits around and shrugs its shoulders because it couldn't go to the exact hex it thought about. It just, it can't think well enough for it, and it's a shame.
To not use it at all, it's like, that's a waste. That's a complete waste for the immersion of the game, for one thing.
The AI, in addition to its other deficiencies in combat, it just screams even more when it comes to Air Force. They could do that to, yes, harass the player, which they absolutely should be doing, particularly if I'm coming in with bombers. Just put a fighter in there. Just one. And they don't. My gosh, not only are you not thinking proactively, but you're not even reacting well to the fact that I have that in there. Ten things from previous Civs to bring back. Thread started by Simo. Following is a list of things that should have gone from previous Civs, but they added spice to the game that I wish would come back. Number one, first to navigate the globe gets +1 naval movement. This used to be a fun challenge with the use for rewards, sending off a boat as soon as possible to scout the world, trying to find your way right round first. I always kind of wondered, okay, it's the first to navigate the globe gets +1 naval movement. I like that for the unit that actually did that. I could see someone saying, not really certain that should apply to every unit on the map, but the fact that now you achieve this movement of being able to navigate the globe, and you do get nothing. You should get something.
Yeah, well, the concept is okay, maybe not the reward. It's kind of like bragging rights, and you should get something for that, but not necessarily plus one naval movement. Just because you know the world is round and you manage to get a boat around it, that doesn't make your boats any faster. But you should get something.
It should be the same as like a wonder. Discovering the world is round is a wonder. And in that way, certainly there's not going to be any building or adjacency bonuses for something like that, but obviously. But there is some level of culture that you get for that, and it should be the same for discovering that the world's around.
Yeah. You get an inherent bonus for first to do something. A little extra, say, touristy or culture bonus or something, depending on what it happens to be.
I kind of like the idea of a eureka moment for something.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure what that eureka would lead into.
Well, let's see. No one figured out that the world was fully navigable until Renaissance. It'd have to be some form of boating tech in the Renaissance.
Yeah.
Either culturally or the other. So it could be naval engineering, maybe.
Yeah.
Something along that line. Or the exploration government.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
There you go. Done. Solved it. Put it in the game.
There we go. Gonna have to make a mod for that one.
If a unit gets to a natural wonder, then if you don't already have astrology, then you've got the eureka boost to astrology. So maybe a eureka boost to your next naval technology. HP fetch, not quite as challenging as you think due to units being able to embark. The fact that it was able to do that with its limited movement and its, especially with barbarians on the map, but not even just barbarians, you know, inability to really defend itself. Actually, that would be impressive if that's how you got the circumnavigation. And then I wonder, what are the other players doing or not doing with naval exploration?
Yeah, of course, the only problem with that is Norway would get it almost always because they can go across ocean really early. Yeah. But I also have to make sure that it was a boat. Or maybe it has to be a caravel. You have to send a caravel around the world. And then that would make it a little safer, because then Norway can't just use a longboat.
Yeah.
That would be more reasonable.
Although I'm always far more impressed when triremes actually manage to get around the world first.
Yeah.
That actually ties into the next suggestion, which was two early boats were able to get to the open seas. Yeah, and Civ 1 and Civ 2, the very first boats were not restricted in how deep water they could go. Rather, once you entered the ocean, there was only a 25% chance of survival.
Yeah.
What this did is allow your chance at early exploration at your own risk. It was a slight chance, but it was yours to take, and it was quite fun. Yeah, the strategy for that was, okay, I'm just going to do a little bit of exploration with, for example, my galleon Civ 2, and I'm going to go one hex onto the ocean, and then I'm going to get off of the ocean on the turn rollover so I can see, okay, how many ocean hexes am I going to be able to have to cross? So hopefully you could find that one place on the map where there was one ocean hex. And HP, again, also this is an H patch, he's like, works better in early games when it takes less turns to cross the ocean and then makes references to save scumming.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to spend all that time save scumming for that,
yeah, well,
that's your choice, then what does that really particularly matter?
Yeah.
You're not progressing any farther in the game. I was able to take my early boat across the open seas. It only took me playing that turn 15 times.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not a negative.
No. Oh, and Epic Western says, adding a bit too much luck into the game for my tastes.
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem is they were able to get to open seas because if you think the Mediterranean, Carthage versus Rome, they're all trireme-based, basically. And the Mediterranean is deep enough in the middle of the two that, yeah, it was kind of funky. So maybe what they really, really need to do to get that sort of thing is have a third type of water. So you have deep water, but not, quote-unquote, full ocean. Quote-unquote, full ocean is the, you're going to sink if you get out here. But then
coast, sea, and ocean, maybe?
Yeah, something along that line. And then, quote-unquote, sea would still get out there and have deeper level stuff without going on full ocean.
There's that, or maybe you could have it so that your naval unit has to have a promotion of some kind in recognition of, okay, you have some experience on the water, so you're likely to be the first to be able to cross the open sea is greater because this isn't your first mission. And so So then the chance would be not, woohoo, I've got a promotion, so now I can cross. Increase the chance of survival. Maybe instead of a 25%, you got a 50% chance now of surviving because you're experienced.
Yeah, or if it's within, say, 3 hexes of a landmass, then you can still see the land, and therefore you still have a point of reference for sailing. Which is, I think, more the point for early boating, having points of reference. If you're out in the middle of the ocean where there's absolutely no points of reference, then, yeah, there's a good chance you're going to die. But if you can see a mountain or whatever, then you know enemy that way.
Yeah.
Or there's more land over there.
You're out in the middle of the Pacific, not so much.
Yeah.
Almost to a level of abstraction, there's less likely to be mutiny on your ship. It's like, hey guys, we can see land, okay? So we we can go ashore, we can make repairs, get provisions, whatever it happens to be. Yeah, as opposed to, let's go that way. But all we see is the horizon of water. Yeah, but there's totally land over yonder. How do you know that?
Because the dragon told me.
The third is also based on the water. Map trading. And yeah, I know, we have talked about this before. Right. This comes up now and again. But according to Simo, why can't we exchange maps anymore? Was always logical and realistic to me. Again, risk versus reward, exposure locations, and knowledge versus gaining info of the world. Why can't we have map exchanging anymore? Because we can't have nice things. I've never seen a developer or the publisher answered the question about where are they. But if they did, I wonder what their answer would be. Why can't we do that anymore?
Yeah, probably because it takes away from the exploration side of things.
Well.
And plus, I mean, early era maps were always really, really crap. Anyways, the game abstracts it too far to the point where if you see something, you know it's there, and it's never changing. And, you know, if a new strategic pops up, you automatically know it's there, even if you haven't been there for, like, 1,000 years or more. So, yeah, you kind of have to think about adjusting what you can see versus what's out there.
Maybe the map that you get from a sieve is just an outline. Okay, yeah, there's land here, but... You want to know what's there? Maybe there's a luxury there. Maybe there's not. Maybe there's a barbarian camp there. Maybe it's not. Why don't you go ahead and find it?
Yeah, but then you also have to throw in, do I want you to know that there's stuff there? So maybe I would only sell you a map that shows my land so that you know where to go to trade, but I'm not going to show you all this cool location on the other side of me that has all these city-states because I don't want you to know about them. So you'd have to start adding more stuff to the mechanics.
And that's fine. I mean, Civ 3 had the ability to get, show me the entire world, or just show me your territorial map. And I guess with that and the diplomacy, it's not also, hey, I just met you. Want to trade maps?
Yeah, that too.
We should have some kind of relationship where we're at least friendly, or at the very least neutral. And fine, if you want this map and we're neutral, it's going to cost you a considerable amount of money. And then you think about, maybe I can just go explore it myself. Or friendly relations, okay, it's going to cost you a little less, but we do have to have some existing relationship. It's not like, you know, the stereotypical dog, which is, you know, I just met you and instantly I love you.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's level that's even lower than that going, how about a trade map? Instead of showing off the whole map or even all your territory map, you would just get this nice thin line from one capital to another or wherever between your two empires to show where you could send a trade route.
I think when we've come to the point in Civilization VI where you already have subcategories for resources, subcategories for war and peace options and negotiation, I don't think it's unfair to ask for like map subcategory where you can say whole world, check off strategic locations, resource locations, other civs that you've met.
Honestly, the thing I most want is the ability to send false maps.
Yeah.
You know, hey, come explore over here. It's a tribal village, and it's actually just like
a bunch of bears.
Grizzly bears.
Uh-huh. I guess the air quotes map training that I can think of is if you declare war on a civ or they declare war on you and they're the suzerain of a city-state, even if you haven't met them, you've now instantly met them because they've declared war on you and you can see their territory. And unfortunately, and any other, you're going to have to channel your inner the me and team here, although it's not just him that is probably going to rail against this. Suggestion number 4, tech trading.
Oh, God, no. No, 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 no. Even I'm going to rail against that one. That was OP stupidly.
There's always talk of balance in game mechanics, but I find rather than slow the leaders, let those lagging behind do some catch-up via trade. Any two wishing to swap tech is their choice. You don't have to give away the shiny new techs. The tech trading that we have, air quotes tech trading, is to have some research agreements.
Well, it's more Eureka trading, but okay. Because you only get Eurekas out of it.
I I could see, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud, if you're constructing a trade route, then it's going to take X number of turns in order for that road to be built. Maybe if you had a research agreement that was 20 turns or 30 turns or whatever, maybe at the end of that, this is starting to get complicated here, tax, like if you're maybe in the same era as someone else and you want to have a research agreement, then you get a tech from that era at the conclusion of that agreement. I mean, anything's possibly exploitable. But that's as far as I'd be willing to try to experiment with, as opposed to, here, on this turn, let's trade this tech, and you instantly have that technology, or they instantly have a technology, or both of you do. Because sometimes it was tech trading for tech, or you could just buy a tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, both of those are problems. Especially if we have a turncast format, where it's just like, hey, new PC neighbor, Dan Quick.
Yo, what's up?
Nice to meet you. I will trade you my pottery for your mining.
Okay.
And before you know it, we both have half the tech tree to ourselves, and we organize.
We're the heir ahead of everybody else, and
we're scientific allies.
Yep. Before you know it, we have four or five people who are each contributing to the tech pool, and you know we're done with the tech pool by like turn 100.
Yeah.
I hereby dub our relationship kumbaya.
Yeah, tech trading's basically not very useful in most games. Unless, of course, there are so many techs in a game that the chances of you finishing them all off by yourself by the time the game's over is very low. That can happen. And then that sort of makes sense a little bit, though I still don't like it. But in a game like Civ, I mean, yeah, Civ 4, I think, had more techs.
It did, yes.
A little bit more space in there, but yeah, the whole tech trading concept, not really a good plan. Phil will talk about how you could easily sell off a crappy tech just to get some good techs and yada, 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 and how that was cheesy and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Or you'd purposely research a tech that no one else bothered to research so that you could trade it because no one would have it, and then you just run around and collect all the ones that everybody would normally research.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was a completely and utterly crap tech. If no one had it, it would be worth something.
It's not a catch-up mechanic. It's a let's gang together and get twice as much tech progress mechanic.
It is helping to catch up, but it's more than that. It's a continual shared research relationship that allows you to not have to make choices.
Yeah.
Number 5 on CMO's list, again, of 10 things from previous Civs to bring back. Wonders that were grand. The wonders in the last few iterations of Civ have been pretty bland. Quantity over quality, especially the version with all the national wonders with world wonders, too many with not enough value. And I read that and I thought, oh, are you talking about Civilization Beyond Earth?
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I don't feel that way towards wonders in general in Civ 6. Yes, there are some wonders in Civ 6 that I think, eh, that's pretty situational, but hey, that's fine. Some wonders I think, this needs some help. I'm looking at you, Great Library. But I don't feel that wonders are not grand in Civilization 6. There are just some that are better than others, and that's any Civ ever.
Well, I think you might be overstating some of the crappier wonders, but it's not. Like, it is much better than building something with great effect than something that offers one or two culture points per turn. That's not really a wonder in the game right
yeah.
now. A lot of the cultural-based wonders all have slots in them for art, and that's actually grand because, well, it's adding a lot of slots and also allowing you to get even more points. Stuff like that is actually more important because it eventually cranks up to having way more than you would be able to get in a city. Yeah, okay, a granary in every city when you built the pyramids. Yeah, okay. But also back then, the granary did something different, so there's that.
Well, that wonder wasn't just grand, it was super grand.
Yeah.
It was the other way, too. That's too much. Too much now.
Yeah, but, I mean, I would say getting a free policy slot from building
yeah.
wonder, that's pretty solid.
Yeah, I pretty aggressively go for Forbidden Palace because of that free policy slot. Like, a lot of these wonders are actually pretty solid, and I will build all of them, except for possibly Great Library.
Yeah, well.
Some wonders, it's like, okay, it's going to become grand because it's not just, okay, you finished the wonder and now done and forget about it. More thinking about the wonder once you actually have the wonder.
Yep.
The other thing with regards to wonders in Civilization VI is, hey, I'm going to put 10 wonders in this city. That's not particularly grand. Oh, I'm sorry, you want to construct the pyramids? So you have desert, right? Oh, you don't? Oh.
That's to be you.
When Simo describes Last Federation's wonders have been bland, that it has a significance of taking up a space on the map and not just necessarily any space, that's interesting. There's actually choices and thinking behind that. And there is one thing with regards to wonders in Civilization VI that I'm glad is not a thing. Guess what? Your wonder is obsolete. F
yep.
you.
Yeah.
Your wonder stopped working. Gosh. What?
How did your wonder stop working?
Like, poke, poke, poke.
Is this they need to change the batteries, Mackie.
Oh.
You know when the pyramids stop working? When you raise them to the ground. That's when they stop working.
Yeah.
Yes. What happened to that? We can't do that anymore. Oh, wait. Yes, you can. You burn the city to the ground and then build it again. Some of those quote-unquote bonuses really should be time-limited, but not stuff like, this thing gives you a trade route. Okay, that thing's going to stop giving you a trade route after a certain point.
Yeah, no. That's not how it works.
Yeah. Speaking of working, number 6 on the list, spies as units. A spy as a unit can be used to investigate the map in enemy cities. You can see troop locations, city specifics, but were visible to other spies who can then get rid of you. Maybe integrate the turn-based system of 6-6 by moving them into a city to do missions with the surveillance aspect of troops, cities, etc. is currently gone and needs to come back. It depends so much on implementation here.
That's what great people are for, didn't you know?
Yeah.
Because the worst thing that happens when you send your great merchant out there to go search the world is that it just gets teleported back to your city if a barb tried to eat it.
Yes.
But spies, I don't know, more units on the map.
Just feels like it's extra overhead to do stuff just for the sake of doing stuff rather than making it better.
The fact that you can have a spy in a city center now, or you can put a spy in a district as well, it's an air quote unit. Because it is specifically on a place on a map, but it's not moving the units around on the map. So could there be a little bit more diversity in terms of what spies could do in Civ 6? Sure. Spy as a unit, it could work, but I'm not certain if it would work any better than what we already have, where it's a very abstracted unit. Do see yours, that's true. You'll see it stuck in the city. And yes, it has to move to that city, but it does that movement on its own.
I'm just kind of wondering where you'd want your spies to go if it's not either the city center or the districts. I can't go to the pyramids. That sign says off.
Number 7, unit gold from deleting. Simply scale back the ludicrous sums, not get rid of it altogether. Now, you see, the gold you get back from deleting the unit is not paying the maintenance costs.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about unit gold from deleting, the particularly fun part about deleting the unit was, oh, it's about to die next turn to the barbs. Hey, I know. Delete. Screw you.
Yeah, I'm just going to turn this one guy out of, the 20 that started into a pile of cash to buy 19 new people to go with the guy who's was there.
Yep. This makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you could get into, okay, if your unit has only X number of hit points or less, then you get X number of gold back, or X number of gold back if it's... I mean, sure, you could do that, but... Is that really fun? No. It's fine the way it is.
Oh, I'm sure somebody thinks it's fun, but...
And I mean, you could even go as far as to say that you can't delete a unit unless they're in your territory.
Well, you can delete units if they're not in your territory, but you're, basically telling them that they're just going to die. Which is basically the same thing anyways.
Well, I mean, if the unit is in your territory and you were to, say, decommission a force, then you take what's left from that and apply it elsewhere. Whereas out in the wild, yeah, that's ridiculous. You shouldn't get gold for that at all.
You shouldn't get anything for that. Now, if units took a point of population to make, then if you brought it back to a city, you could delete it and get a point of population back, or some portion thereof in food for the city. Or you could bring it back to an encampment, and deleting it would provide you with some equipment for that type of unit.
Yeah, maybe give you a little production boost on the next unit of that type.
Yeah.
That'd be fine.
Not a different unit.
Yeah, I'm going to bring the warrior back to my city. Here's the loincloth, infantryman.
Yep.
Civil War is the 8th suggestion from Simo.
Oh.
I miss this one so much. Another great early Civ counter to a large empire. If someone is huge, then you attack the capital, and if you take it, then it splits the nation into two. Oh, it was such a great system. I guess we're going to disagree on great. It was a system. Sure. Naturally, it was hard to capture a capital buried deep, but it was meant to be a challenge. What a great mechanic that disappeared.
Yeah, I think we're all going to disagree on the word great there.
Yeah.
It was interesting the first time you had it happen in a game, but after that, it was like, oh, please stop.
I feel like we kind of already have Civil War in the form of, hey, we haven't had sufficient number of entities for an extended period of time.
Oh, yeah.
Guess what? Here's some rebels. Now, we've talked about the efficacy of those rebels being an issue, but I prefer that approach to particularly the fact that he mentions splitting the nation into two because you attack the capital and you take the capital. It's like, oh.
Yeah, because that automatically caused this quote-unquote civil war when somebody external went and took the capital.
Yeah.
No. I'm okay with the concept of civil war being in the game, but, well, one, we need more leaders. More alt leaders, even.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd have to have, like, clone Gandhi versus Gandhi. It'd be weird.
And then you're going on Earth territory again.
Yeah. But then I would also say that the Civil War would have to, Dan was talking about, pop up because you played the game badly. So yeah. If you went huge, but you didn't bother providing amenities for your people, and they all
then
got cheese.
It's a Civil War.
Yeah. You would have to purposely play badly. The way they set this up is like, oh, a great early civ counter to a large empire. No. Just because somebody got big doesn't mean they have to naturally get chopped in half because you didn't bother getting big.
So you want one of the 4Xs to be removed from 4X is what they're saying.
Yeah, it is pretty much, yeah. Just for being large. So, meh.
Your empire is large and unhappy as heck. Well, then sure, but...
The empire is large and in charge of its own destruction. Wait, what?
But civil wars can happen on small places, too.
Yeah.
You can sit there with your four-city empire, and if you have absolutely no amenities and you've been at war for way too long and refuse to get out of it, yeah, you don't have to be a large empire to get a civil war.
And seeing as how with amenities now in Civ 6, it's like, okay, hook this amenity up. So, okay, you know, and there's the automatic calculation about, okay, so there are cities that you have are going to give one amenity to this city that's near here and one amenity to the city that's not near here. So this is where you get the, oh, I don't have this same negative or positive amenity value in every single one of my cities just because it's in one city. It's in all the cities. So, you know, those cities on the front, because you just founded or you captured them and you think, okay, you know, I've been there, done that. You guys, you know, stay loyal to me. And how come all the amenities are going to these other people? We've got these amenities out in the field that we could have improved, but they haven't bothered to improve it. Or, hey, it's been pillaged by barbs for some time. Now, it doesn't mean instantly, like you separate, you know, become independent. But it's just you're more likely to have the rebel spawn because, fine, we're going to get your attention now. Since something else seems to be working.
Yeah, and well, frankly, there is an in-game difference between cities you founded and cities you took over.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on the war weariness. So if those cities you just conquered in your war are super pissed at you because, well, you're still fighting that war and they're taking all the war weariness, sure, why wouldn't they just randomly rise up and fight you back?
Nope, we're forming our own nation. Get out.
Particularly if you've moved your troops on.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no troops in the area.
Fine, we'll be the troops in the area.
Our empire now, you come take it back.
Now, H-Patch did say, well, an interesting option against large enemies in single player. This is almost a guaranteed raid quit in multiplayer. Well, I think in single player, if your capital was taken, you're already kind of behind the eight ball, but then your empire splits into two. And, yeah, that's just more rage quit. Number 9, the space race landing. In Civ 1 and 2, you did not win the space race by launching. You won by landing on Alpha Centauri, and the time it took to get there was subjective on how much power you would build your spaceship. And I'm going to stop reading right there, because in Civilization 6, it's not, hey, guess what? In one city, with one construct, space, I win. I've launched. No, we don't even have to get into that. It's not the, okay, the counter is on. It's, hey, guys, they've just researched robotics. Hey, guys, they've just built the habitation component. And that can be tracked. It's a series of things that you have to construct across one or more spaceports. You could have what they've suggested here, the space race landing, where it's, okay, you've got X number of turns to try to be able to do something to stop them. But I actually prefer what we have in Civ 6 because it's staggered and it's something that you can monitor on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's positive and negatives in this one. I think it was an interesting mechanic so that it was a bit of a race going, okay, so how many pieces am I putting on this spaceship? Do I take a little bit longer to build and it'll get there faster? Or do I go bare bones and hope I get there before somebody else launches something more powerful? That was kind of interesting in the race perspective.
That's true.
the, oh, well, I can capture your capital to randomly blow up your spaceship that hasn't been near the planet for how long?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. The point of winning the space race is that you got off the planet in the first place, not that you found the magic make it explode button in the capital somewhere. The point of the space victory is that you left. Really doesn't matter what's going on back on the Earth anymore at that point. But it is a multiple step setup, and you know every time somebody finishes one of those steps, it's very clear. As soon as the first step happens, you know you've got a period of time to prevent the rest of it. So I think on that respect, it's fine that it shows up at the end. I don't think we can bring back the let's launch before it's done part, at least with the way Civ 6 is set up.
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent, if you really wanted to play with that, you could make the program where researching this tech adds so much to a percentage of success of launch, or offsets a certain percentage of failure.
Number 10 on SEMO's list in the thread started by SEMO was unit stats. Used to love looking at how many units I had lost, built, and same for my enemies. It would be great if this came back and was expanded to group into overall specific wars and such. Little things, but added great interest to me.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Data.
I don't feel like it's missing, as in I absolutely have to have this in order to enjoy the game. But, yeah, it would be nice.
I mean, it provides narrative, right?
It does. It would be easy to track in the coding, I would think, and then just have a nice little user interface to display that information. And you go looking for it, and if you want, and if you don't, you don't.
I do a collection of Civ mods for, like, one of the websites I work for, and I think I've seen something like this already. It's not that hard to accomplish.
No.
30 in there.
Elsewise in the thread, there was one person who suggested 5 more from Urich. Number 11, true huge maps.
Well, sure. I want my 5,000 by 5,000 size map, but I also want the supercomputer that can run it.
I was about to say, and I also want turn times that don't last 5 to 6 minutes. The option of a map not only connecting east to west, but also north to south.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
We used to have north-south maps. Unless he's talking about no side-scrolling common map, but rather being able to go north to south, which is a little confusing. You'd have to go around for that to really exist. We already said no to that. And even then, you couldn't directly do it because you're actually really going around. So
number 13, transporter units instead of embark.
No.
No.
Like how it is now, thank you.
I admit, when they first talked about getting rid of that in Civ 5, I thought, I don't know. That sounds a little too easy, this, that, and the other thing. You know, I'm not happy with transporter units, but I don't know about getting rid of them. No, I'm certain about that now.
They have to deal with embarked units a little better than they do right now. Right now, being embarked only reduces your combat strength by like 4 or something stupid like that. And I'm sorry, your swordsman who is swimming in the ocean is not at the same combat strength as my boat that can smash you.
It is humorous. It's like, oh, yeah, there's a swordsman in the water. I'm going to take my battleship. Still have half of its hit points left.
Yeah, what's with that crap?
Option to exclude city-states from the game and option for vassal states.
Obviously.
I initially read that as to exclude certain city-states from the game.
Can't you slider that down to 0?
Yeah.
See? Already done!
Option for vassal states, that's a whole other separate...
Yeah, it's a mechanic.
Well, what do you mean by vassal states?
Well, maybe if you go smash and grab somebody instead of just taking their cities, you say you're my little puppet now.
How very PG of you, but yes. Yes.
Yeah. You're my puppet. You do what I tell you. And then people hate you a little less because you puppeted them rather than wiped them out. Maybe.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to Polycast episode number 285. I'm New Earth Relic, joined by regular co-host Dan Q.
Get out and about.
Mad Jin.
About and about.
Makalua.
I'm on a boat.
And guest co-host, TJ Denzer.
I'm here too.
Record date?
July 8th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.